You might be familiar with the slippery slope school of argumentation. It looks something like this in general. So this is the benign version of the slippery slope argument. Lost your pen equals no pen. No pen equals no notes. No notes equals no study. No study equals fail. Fail equals no diploma. This thing makes all kinds of assumptions. No diploma equals no work. No work equals no money. No money equals no food. No food equals skinny. Skinny equals ugly. I'm not sure exactly what culture this came from. Ugly equals no love. No love equals no marriage. No marriage equals no children. The string of assumption goes on. No children equals alone. Alone equals depression. Depression equals sickness. Sickness equals death. Let me sum up. If you were encountering the slippery slope argument method, what you would hear is, if you lose your pen, you will die. The intermediate steps would be missing. That's important. So you might have encountered this kind of logic in many places. You may have encountered it in some memorable instances as being used to make moral arguments. And that's what the cartoon that you weren't allowed to read was, because I'm a control freak. Close your eyes. No, we're there now. So who knew there's a website called leftycartoons.com? This is from there, in case you don't recognize the particular bias in here. But anyway, so what this is some high-profile instances of a slippery slope argument as they might be seen in relationship to landmark American court decisions. Loving versus Virginia, 1967. Just you watch now that black can marry white. People marrying house pets is just around the corner. These are actual arguments, by the way. Roe versus Wade, 1973. Now that abortion is legal, we're certain to make it legal to commit infanticide any year now. Goodrich, 2003, if gays can marry, legal incest and bigamy will come next. It's inevitable. Dude, I don't think this slope is nearly as slippery as you think it is. Oh, shut up. Which is always a great rejoinder in dialogue. The slippery slope argument actually has an acronym. It's an actual piece of logic in terms of method. The SSA, in logic, critical thinking, political rhetoric, and I actually think I have this particular definition on a slide as well because it's a little longer. And case law, it's a consequentialist logical device in which a party asserts that a relatively small first step leads to a chain of related events culminating in some significant, usually negative, effect. And just in case consequentialist logical device left you working just a little too hard for this hour of the day, let me put it into shorter words. When we say something is a slippery slope, we usually mean that some choice or course of action will inevitably lead to the next and then the next and so on to an unintended but inevitable consequence. And in the slippery slope argument method, the basic stem is if you blank, then blank. That's the whole chain. All the intermediate steps are missing in action. And that's what makes it a slippery slope argument, is that there is no defense, there is no explanation for the intervening steps. You go right from here to there. That's how it works. And as far as what kind of logic that is, it's called a logical fallacy. And the reason it's called logical fallacy is because there's no argument made to justify the steps between the first step and the last step. It's inevitable. That's the fallacy, as simply stated as it can be. Now, this is a frequently used rhetorical device, and it's not unusual for it to be used in ways that prey on our emotions, and especially on fear. It's a very powerful emotion and not that difficult to access a lot of the time. And that's what the cartoon was about. If we take this particular moral step, it will inevitably lead to one that we think most people might find objectionable or fearful or, in some cases, in the cartoon at least, absurd. But it pushes a button right away. People that speak to convince others of something might gravitate to this kind of argument. You know some of those kind of people. Politicians, preachers. And it can be pretty effective when it comes to eliciting a response. It's a great shortcut when it comes to skipping over complexities and nuances and possibilities. It's a great way to avoid exploring. If you do this, it's going to end up there. No work necessary in between. Thanks very much. And this morning what I want to do is I basically want to kind of subvert that. I want to use it as a kind of a long cut instead of a shortcut. I want to use it as a device for revealing why I think that's not a great way to treat spiritual matters, and it's not a great way to move us toward change. And just to keep all of this from being too obvious, I want to keep the subtext of Lent kind of perking along in the background as well. So we'll see how that goes. It's been a few weeks now since we've been in the prayer for I don't know what I believe or space, and I want to get back there as we said we would. If you were around for the beginning of those explorations that I was calling that, you might recall that our guide for getting into those was an artist and writer named Julia Cameron, best known for her book and workshops called The Artist's Way. But that's not what we're referencing from her in this. We're working with a book of hers called Prayers from a Non-Believer, A Story of Faith, which is already, to me, the book was interesting before I opened it because the title puts things together that we often don't. The particular prayer of hers from this book that is our prayer for today is this one. Dear God, full disclosure, I am only undertaking these prayers as an experiment at the suggestion of a friend. I have not had a spiritual awakening, and I frankly doubt that I ever will. My friend, who is a bit perky, and even New Age if you ask me, suggested I try thinking of you as an invisible playmate. In light of things like death and the Holocaust, that made me feel like I was trying to talk to the invisible bully. Will I get struck by lightning for saying that? As I have said from the beginning, I don't officially believe in you, although even logic seems to say something must have made all this. We're not going to get into the particular philosophical argument that underpins that sentence today, but maybe another time. It's funny how I can not believe in you and still blame you. That is funny, isn't it? That happens. I guess I think of you a bit like God the Father after all. You know how kids always blame their parents. But I do not want a parent-child relationship with you. I'm not sure I want any relationship at all. But I do wonder if I might not be late to that party. Maybe we've already got a relationship and I'm just pretending we don't. Kind of like, all right, I put my arm around you at the movie, but it didn't mean anything, so don't get carried away. Don't get carried away, God. These letters don't mean I'm your new best friend. I'm just thinking about you, if there is a you, that is. Funny how just entertaining that possibility makes it seem somehow more possible. Do you think prayer is the greased slide to faith? Greased slide is, of course, just another way of saying slippery slope. More picturesque, more messy, but the same picture. Once you start, you can't stop. Cameron, to my delight, uses the image as an open question rather than as a rhetorical statement of fact. Do you think prayer is the greased slide to faith? Not quite a convinced slippery slope argument, which would be prayer is the greased slide to faith. None of what I'm about to say about this is inevitable or foregone, but I think some of it is possible. I think some of it's even reasonable. I think it's more of a, you know, that just might work than if you do X, I guarantee Y, which I think probably fits the space we're in here just a little bit better. One of the reasons that we are drawn as humans to things like slippery slope arguments is because we like patterns. Patterns help us, and among other things, they help us by shortcutting things that are routine. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I suspect that for many of our brains, it would have been easier to just drive straight to Pantages this morning, right? Because that's we don't need to think that one through. We know how that goes, so that's really important. We do this stuff because it works, because our brains are full, and we want to try to download some tasks to shortcuts. And that helps us to redistribute our limited resources for what might feel like more urgent or more high-demand things in our lives. It took me about a year to stop making the wrong left turn to work when I changed the job that I'd been at for 12 years. Like, I had to be, all of a sudden, I had to be conscious of not taking that corner. I had to undo the shortcut for quite a long time. Which is probably doesn't say great things about what happens inside my brain, but there you go, true confession. So, but we can do this, right? We can make shortcuts, and that's great because that's one of the ways that we're equipped to get a lot done. That's great, and we need it, and so that's all fine. But there are some problems that come with it. And one of the problems that comes with this particular way that our brains work is that it's easy to have things that once mattered a lot to us, things that once got front burner attention from us, it's easy to have those things become routine and to get dealt with in shortcut kinds of ways. It's easy for us, because of this feature of our brains, it's easy for us to lose sight of what matters the most, because once we start to treat important things as routine, we can also easily start to treat those things as though they really were less important to us. And there's probably no place in our lives where this causes more grief than it does in relationships. One of the reasons I would say that that is the case is because I don't know anybody that likes to be treated like a shortcut. Maybe there are people who really like that, but generally speaking, I think the feeling that we're being managed rather than cherished, that's an ugly feeling. And we and our relationships don't tend to thrive under those circumstances. This year, Lent started on Valentine's Day, which got me thinking kind of unusual thoughts about both Valentine's and Lent. And there are, of course, lots more kinds of relationships than just romantic ones, which is partly what makes a day like Valentine's potentially very painful for lots of people. But I ended up thinking, why not bring together some of the core values of Lent and some of the things we might find challenging about relationships and see what happens. So basically that's what we're going to do this morning. So you might recall that we've talked here at the table about these ideas, these Lenten ideas of putting something down or taking something on as a practice in Lent. And basically the idea behind that is that Lent is a season for conscious consideration. Consideration of the shape of our lives, consideration of the nature and connection, condition of our connection with God, the reflection on the state of our relationships with one another, with the place we call home, whether that's whether I mean by that an address or a planet. Those things are all deeply interconnected, but we're not always conscious of that interconnection. So to get us thinking about what matters most in our lives, in the season of Lent, we may choose to either put something down, and we might use fasting language if we're using sort of traditional language for this, but we might talk about putting something down or taking something up, deliberately adding something to our lives such that it provokes conscious attendance to those big themes and questions that we might otherwise make routine or shortcut. I know the answer to that. I don't have to think about it. I don't know very many places in my life, idea spaces, that are more prone to this than religion. I already know the answer to that. I don't have to think about it. And when I show up for spiritual community, faith community, church, whatever kind of language you want to use for it, I show up for it to be reassured that my shortcut is fine. And if you want to piss me off, just tell me it's not. Just mess with my shortcut. So I don't want to think about that. I've got enough to think about. Plus, if I settle the cosmic questions and I don't have to think about them, I don't have to face the distress of that. Because frankly, questioning our shortcuts, especially when they're about the big pieces, can be a crazy maker. And once again, back to relationships. Man, I don't know of a way that, I don't know of a thing that's harder, and I can think of several instances that I'm close to where this is the case, where one person is questioning their religious shortcuts and the other person isn't. That's hard work. That's not an easy space. It takes a lot of mutual grace to navigate that space well. So it's a hard thing to do. It's an important thing to do. We are surrounded, fire hosed, I would say really, by information on pretty much everything, including relationships, of course. That's a short Google search for lots of results. So as I was considering the question, where might we turn to be reminded of what's truly important when it comes to relationships, I thought we could probably do a lot worse than to consider the enduring wisdom of Christendom's ancient text and the Hebrew people's ancient texts. And there's lots of ways we could do that. But I've chosen the doorway of what I'm going to call the one another's. In the New Testament in particular, there's a Greek word, it's actually two Greek words, but that we translate it as one another in most English translations. That little piece of Greek text occurs just under 100 times in the New Testament. So the New Testament has lots to say about how we deal with one another, how we relate to each other. And I'm obviously not going to start going through all of them, but here's what I want to do this morning. I'm going to put a list of a bunch of those on the screen. And I know the print is pretty small, but we'll have some time with it, so I think we're going to be okay. There's three bunches there, basically, unity, love, humility, and then there's a few stragglers. This is not an exhaustive list, just so you know, because some of the things on the one another list would take a bit too much explaining, or taken out of context, they just seem weird. So let me give you an example. There are at least four one another texts in the New Testament that are about kissing, but they have nothing to do with romance or eros. So that would take a little explaining. They're not up there. But you can look them up if you want. There's also one about not devouring one another, but it's not related to kissing. Also a bit strange, out of context. And so some of them are just, you know, very contextual. I've sort of tried to edit this just a little wee bit. So this bunch is up here, though, as a reference for us, okay? I hope the reason I've done that is going to make sense in a moment. If you have a favorite one another text, and some of you might, that's not up there, then in the exercise I'm going to give us in a moment, just work with your favorite. Doesn't matter. You're not limited to the list. But I think you'll find most of them up there. All right, so there's this whole batch of one another texts in front of us. Here's what I want us to do with that this morning. So your Lenten assignment, should you choose to accept it, is take a few moments and consider the list. And then ask yourself a question something like this. What do I see here that I recognize as something I'm either not doing but should be? Your sense of oughtness is where you measure this against, okay? Your sense of should. What do I see here that I recognize as something I'm either not doing but should be, or that I am doing but shouldn't be in such a way that it hinders my relationships? In other words, if we wanted to put it into that pick up, put down framework, what is one thing I see here that I should put down, or one thing I see here that I should pick up? And then the attendant question, which we'll come back to in a moment, is just very practical. We'll get to this. Basically, what do I need to do as a Lenten practice to move toward that? So I'll say more about that in a moment. But let me give you just a couple minutes with the list, first of all. So do feel free, you can pick as many as you want, be as zealous as you wish, but I would encourage you to pick one, either a put down or a pick up. So just one. And then we'll get to part B, all right? It's pretty easy with lists of do's or don'ts to sort of fall into a really binary space. Either you do these things or you don't do these things. Either the switch is on or the switch is off. One of the reasons why I find this list, why I remain open to a list like this in the face of a challenge like that, is because it contains things like gently, patiently tolerate one another. I love that one. Well, that's not an on-off switch, I don't think. That's got lots of wiggle room. When is it gently? When is it patiently? What does tolerance look like? Now I'm tolerant, now I'm not tolerant. It doesn't really fall to that so easily, does it? All right. Was that a useful exercise? Did you feel like you could hit one and kind of go, yep, I see that one in me, or I don't see that one? Yeah? Okay. So, here's part two. Having kind of encountered one that feels like I need to pick that up or I need to put that down, the question is, what do I need to do each day of Lent to begin moving toward that? And then in the spirit of Lenten practice, what we need to do is figure out how to make that action a daily practice in an embodied way. And this is where this sort of falls apart for lots of people, because this is where the heroic inclination can kick in. You know, I'm just going to do this all the time. Nope. Almost never works. Just the fact of the matter. Doesn't tend to produce change, tends to produce frustration, and then failure, and then shame, and then to hell with it. Right? Like it just does not usually work. So a different way to think about this entirely is like you would think about any other thing that you had to get done in the day. What is, and you can just, you don't have to apply this to this assignment, but just give me a little bit of feedback on this. What are the things that you do to remember to do something that's important to you? Depending how important things are to me, I change the ink. Okay? Guess which list is urgent today? Right, the one that I wrote in Sharpie. Kareen always looks at that stuff and goes, could you just try to write? Like, it's, no, just, it doesn't matter that it can't read it. I took the time to make a mark. Belt, what is belt dressing?
Belt.
Belt dressing. Yeah, it's like looking in my sock drawer there, having to show you. Chicken at co-op is that other one. I bet you couldn't read that one, huh? All right. Belt dressing, that's a mechanical thing. We can talk about it later if you want. I'll confess all about belt dressing. But it's interesting, isn't it? I'm reading Daniel Levitin's book, The Organized Mind, and so he spends a bunch of time on the neuroscience of this and the lovely popularized way that he has of writing about big ideas. And all of the things we just described have something to do with the way our brains file stuff away. And we're always trying to find a way to put the things we need to remember in proximity to other things. So we're grouping things, essentially, is what we're doing. We're making groups of like kinds of things. And so that's why we put our keys in our shoe, or we put our skis and our boots and our poles across the door, or in the car, or we make a list, or we sing a song, or whatever, right? So we associate things, we group them together. So if we're going to actually work toward change in our lives, including spiritual change, including picking things up or putting things down in Lent, we need to use the same kind of practice. It's not like we get to switch off the way our brain works because we moved into something we're thinking of as a spiritual discipline or practice. Like, just the opposite. If there's ever a better intersection where we can bring together the best of neuroscience and the best of the mysteriousness that we use words like spiritual for, it's when it comes to change. Because change is a practice and a process. We actually have to do things if we're going to change. If we think about God primarily, this is too big, and I'm just going to gesture toward it and carry on, but if we think of God as kind of like this Santa Claus figure, this fairy godparent kind of idea, and we're waiting for God to zap us with change, we basically are just living a life in which we are being willfully ignorant about the way we have already been made as humans, the way we already are, however we understand how we got there. We're just ignoring the fact that we're already wired for this, but we have to choose it. If you're waiting for God to zap you into change, just pay attention to how your brain's wired and then go, oh, God already did. If you believe you're a product of the divine in any way, you already got zapped for change. Now, over to you, right? We can do this, but we have to choose it. Short version. So, we do have things that we can't explain. We have epiphanies, we have moments of profound transformation. All those things do happen, and then we usually spend the whole rest of our life trying to figure out what they mean, trying to find a frame for them. But more often, by far, change comes because of dailiness. It happens because we choose to take ordinary steps one at a time to practice something one step at a time over time. That's not a very appealing idea, is it? That's not very sexy. Getting zapped into being a better person is so much more appealing thought than practicing. And I mean, if it's relational practice, like who's going to stick around for that? Good question, right? If you find that person, you see if you can work out a mutual commitment. You know? Stick around. I've got some changing to do. You know, we use a short word like love for things like that. One step at a time, no shortcutting. Now, what does this all have to do with slippery slopes and prayer? Well, here is my that just might work thought. When we think about prayer, we don't tend, I think, generally to think about action. I mean, if we're thinking about what is prayer, we might think about actions that we think describe what praying looks like. So we might think about the things that constitute prayer. We might think about talking to God. We might think about listening to God. We might think about reciting something that's a formal prayer or making a prayer up on the spot, extemporaneous prayer if you've grown up in any number of Protestant traditions. We might think about thanking God before a meal. We might think about, the bargaining we do with the divine as we're grasping the coolness of the toilet bowl. God, get me out of this alive, and I'll never drink that or do that, whatever, again. Those kind of prayers. None of you have ever prayed those prayers, but you've seen them in movies, right? Yeah. Yeah. And then I wrote in my notes, actions we might normally call praying. Anyway, I'm not sure the last one's included in normally call praying, but occasionally. For lots of us, whether we think about it as a monologue or a dialogue, prayer is kind of this self-contained thing unto itself. It's sort of its own category. But I want to encourage us this morning to think about it a little differently. How often do we think of actions as doing something as prayer? And I'm not talking about the list I just rattled off or things like it. I'm not talking about the actions that constitute prayer typically. How often do we think about daily actions as prayer? If you think about prayer as communication, the majority of our communication with one another is nonverbal. Huge amount of what we communicate is nonverbal, right? Now, if prayer is a kind of communication with the divine, why wouldn't we think of our actions, not the least of all our actions toward one another, as prayer? And if we feel like we need a textual reference for this, we have the teaching of Jesus, which is, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. If we think about Jesus as divine, and I realize not everyone in the room does, but if we think about Jesus that way, and Jesus is saying, if you do it to me, you did it to God, and if you do it to one another, it's like you did it to me, right? So our actions, that's a pretty good short explanation of how actions are prayer. In all my growing up at home years, there was this magnet on the kitchen fridge that said, prayer changes things. And that's just vague enough to still appeal to me. It's not quite mechanistic. There's a little bit of room for mystery in there. And it seems to fit for me. It seems to fit with the possibility that actions thought of as prayers might be especially effective when it comes to producing change in me, around me, between others and myself. And I don't want to overstate this, because if I do, I'm going to fall prey to a logical fallacy. So I'm just going to offer it to you as a question, and then you can take it from there. Could action as prayer be the slippery slope, the grease slide to spiritual transformation? That's probably only one way to find out, right? So, peace.